Blog Talk Radio.
Well, folks, first of all, happy holidays and welcome to another edition of Politics Done Right. I'm Victor Willis, your host. It's been a very, very long week. There's a whole lot that happened. And what are we going to talk about today? Well, I think I put myself to it today because I decided to tackle two things. Up for this day, as well as Edward Snowden. Is he a hero? Is he a traitor? Is he really bringing anything new to the NSA debate? What do you think? I would love to hear from you. Interesting. This morning I got up and you know, I had this Edward Snowden on my mind, and by the way, we're going to start with the up for the ADA, but I just wanted to bring this up because it's sort of hot right now. I wrote a post and I titled it, what did I title it? I think I titled it the post. I think I placed it up on the coffee site as well. Snowden is no hero yet. NSA surveillance, security privacy balance needed. The idea of this post was open that debate as to whether Snowden is a net positive or net negative. The media narrative, and so if you're calling and you want to speak, please remember to push one to tell me that you're not just listening on the phone, that you wanted to actually say something. The phone's open for everybody and any side of any of the debates that we have. We make sure to be everybody their share, their fair time to speak, and in on this program, we don't attack, we let people have that platform where they express themselves, whatever it is, as the opinion is, of course, as long as the opinion is presented civilly. In other words, without cutting, without doing anything crazy, we want to hear all your opinions. The number is 929-2495. Again, that number is 646-929-2495. Of course, you can send me a tweet at Egberto Willis. It can be sent at Egberto Willis if you also want to send me a quick message or something as well. But as I mentioned before, I went ahead and wrote this post at Daily Code, and I placed a coffee party as joint coffee party movement at the Facebook page as well. I got blasted for taking the position that I think ultimately Snowden's doing is a net negative. It's not a popular opinion to have at the day court, and boy, am I paying for it. I mean, the message board over there is going berserk. And put it bluntly, despair's blind. So for all of those who look and say, why is that? That opinion is not well taken over in some locations, but until proven otherwise, I must And what's for today? This week, Coral Gibson, a young activist, someone that I actually interviewed on my the movement that I co-host, is a wonderful activist in America or U.S. Uncut. And he's done a lot for the AKM movement and a lot of other movements. But he wrote an interesting reader-submitted news piece saying that he's going to pay the penalty for the Affordable Care Act in lieu of actually getting insurance. And he made a whole lot of statements that I'll read in the post by Catherine Hott on the Daily Coast tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central Standard Time. This week, Carl Gibson, a young reader, reported a tweet. He was fine instead of getting the Affordable Care Act of MKCA. Ed raised his head on Christmas Day. He maintained his arrogant stand as he put America's intelligence in danger for unnecessary altruistic reason. In my humble opinion, Edward Snowden is a traitor. Do you think the folks who really hit me hard on the coast says that I have no idea what the real meaning of traitor is? That is, of course. And many of them view what he did as something somebody had to do. First, I ask the question, no matter what it is that we're doing right now, did we really want to risk this information going into the hands of foreign powers? Some of them, for sure, are much more intrusive of the civil rights of their people than we are. But somehow, it's going to seem to be otherwise by adapting Snowden. We'll go to that second topic. So what I'll do at first is to read that blog that will be going hot out tomorrow at the coast at 3 p.m. And goes it. O'Donnell on his Thursday show illustrates a problem with the left. It also illustrates a problem with the very young. Be sure. This problem was created by the baby boomers. The youth, specifically on the left, tend to believe, many times correctly, that the interest out of policy. That is what Carl Gibson believes. He believes this specifically as applies to the Affordable Care Act. For the reason, Gibson is well-known young and environmental activist. He is the co-founder of U.S. Uncut. He is also a prolific blogger at HuffPost. He reports for AKM.com. Carl Gibson as a platform. I interviewed him on my Move to End Report radio show a few months ago. I found him very engaging, knowledgeable, and convincing. It's for this reason that the RSN was so disconcerting. Carl Gibson laid out the mental path, argument he made to himself for not standing up for the Affordable Care Act. His argument makes sense only if he is trying to convince himself not to do something he intrinsically knows he should do. Carl Gibson announced this is basically this. He exercises, eats well. He does not take the flu shot. He meditates. So far in his 26 years of life, he has only had the simple. His biggest healthcare cost was $6,000 for a surgery in 2011 when he broke his elbow. Even without insurance, he was at near break even, as his premiums and deductibles would be close to that. Based on his current earnings, of pocket health care costs would be 15% of his income. In 2013, he was run off the road. a closer clinic refused to see him because he was insured. The hospital he drove for, x-ray, bandage, and sling cost $2,500. He figures he would still be ahead in 2013, opting to be uninsured. Carl Gibson misses several things. First, he has a proposed planet. I have no acts requiring hospitalization, even as a cyclist for over 12 years. I mean, I've ridden the hills of Central Texas, the hills of Mid-Texas, the flatlands, the hotlands, the swamplands, all over Texas and Louisiana. And knock on wood, I've been lucky thus far, have not ever had to go to the hospital yet. I have never been uninsured. I was lucky enough to be able to have insurance, to be able to afford insurance. But second, prices that he quoted an uninsured person was likely subsidized by all those paying insurance as well as taxes. Not taking that is a responsible thing to do, especially if one uninsured. Right here, the swine flu is prevalent strain this year, and there have been several flu deaths in the Houston area already, and likely around the country. After Carl Gibson laid out the reason he just out of Obamacare, he went into the issue of Obamacare to address. Gibson is absolutely correct that a single-payer system would have been the preferred option. Profits, executive salaries, and unnecessary overhead simply pay a compounding bill. Doesn't take any much intelligence to pay a bill. He is correct that health insurance companies are nothing but about entities created to profit off of sick. Absolute correct. He's correct that political bribery is responsible for a much less than optimal Affordable Care Act. Lawrence attempted to convince Coach Gibson of his folly by bringing in Governor Howard Dean to recline to his show for a pleasant debate. He said, this was all that was attainable at this time. He advised Gibson that he still needed to opt in to the Obamacare to ensure he is protected from possible future catastrophe. Gibson was a bit blunt. He said, want to do the Jewish thing and be a traitor. Edge Howard Gibson a civics lesson we fail to teach many of our young. He said, it is a mistake to think about yourself of having a singular relationship with the healthcare system. I am young. Your relationship to the healthcare is wrong. One day, you are going to be old. You sound healthy, but one day, you are going to be sick. And if every young person, every healthy person starts to game the system, and when they are old, and they are sick, there will be no system there that is affordable to take care of them. I've had some problems with what Ezra can have been saying lately on Obamacare. I think a lot of what he said was coming from a technical informed person. Comes to the recent blog post that he's put out there, pretty much been on point. It is really that simple. Ezra Klein called this one right. Ezra Klein also made an important point generally goes unnoticed. In a single-payer system, premiums are not age-based, and as such, the young likely subsidize the old much more than the Obamacare. Under Obamacare, premiums for the old pay up to 3% those of the young. Carl Gibson, a leader, informed on critical issues that can have material long-lasting health and financial effects on those that follow him. That listen to him and that up to him. Carl Gibson leaders must stay in healthier debate. Obamacare is not the end of making the U.S. health system better for all. It is just the beginning. This country needs Gibson and all the U.S. to be a part of demanding policy changes. They must be there continuously at the election if they want to be heard. The Affordable Care engaged. The hypocrisy actions like Gibson's and others to snap incremental change because they are confident, absent and right revolution, they will always get the outcomes they want. Carl Gibson's choice of opting out the Affordable Care Act should be reconsidered for his good and as an example to others. Moreover, he should be at the forefront to ensure not only that young people sign up that issues. Now, what do you think? I would love to hear some comments on the youth and Iraq. Give me a call, 646-929-2495. Again, that number is 646-929-2495. When I wrote about this in several places, the responses I were mostly positive by most of the people, even men who had initially this universal health care, and they understand that many of us, many of those that support the Affordable Care Act, support in it with a big, humongous asterisk. We understand that because of political pressures, one big, vast change to the American health system was not going to occur. It's very unlikely that would occur. Now, the concept of universal health care, plutocracy in America has been anathema to the average American citizen, had to be changed. Would only be changed if an incremental vision was put forth from America to saw somewhat, not entirely, but some universal system that somehow destroys the caricature the right has made up, like Canada, UK, Australia, France, and all these other places. Tundra, my good friend, John, San Antonio, how are you doing, my brother?
Good. I don't know if you realize that your phone is breaking up pretty badly, but anyway, I just thought I'd tell you that.
I had no idea. I don't know why. Wow, it's still real bad?
Yeah, I mean, you can... Well, yeah, it's still pretty. I mean, it's hard to tell when you're not talking, but it seemed like the last time you spoke.
But I don't even know because all of this is going over the internet.
No, I can barely hear. I mean, you're breaking up about every other word. So I mean, you get one word in, you can then it's like the next word is kind of pretty bad. But anyway. I want to comment a little bit. I was able to hear some of what you said, and I think the guy from Occupy, what's his name, Carl Gibson.
Carl Gibson.
I did read the article because I went on your page, a little bit early to see what you're going to talk about, and so I did read his article, and. You know, I'm glad he's an activist, but I think he's really wrong here. I think that he's he doesn't really understand how if you are actually in a car accident, how much money it can devastate your finances. I mean, how much money it'll take from you, and so I just think he's having. I understand to a certain degree because it is a certain, I mean, that's one thing about the deductibles that I was having a hard time dealing with, you know, from the very beginning, from when the numbers first started coming out. And I think we spoke about this over the last few months.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, I mean, the deductibles are just way too high. And the two European countries that have a similar system, the Swiss and the Dutch, their incentives are much better. I mean, the subsidies are good, and this young man is only going to have to pay $150 a month, I believe, and that's what it said in this article. And that's really not a lot of money. I guess his main beef is with the deductible, and I can understand that, but I do think he's kind of playing with fire here. And I was kind of able to decipher what you were saying a little bit when you were reading it. I get you were saying something to the degree that, you know, everybody has to buy into the system for it to work, you know, until we do get single payer. And so I agree with that. And so I hope people don't take him up on what he's doing. I think, in fact, I do want to read a little bit from an article from Sarah Cliff, and it's kind of a contradicting a little bit about what the consensus is. It says, why Obamacare won't spiral into a fiery actuary doom. It says, the rumors of Obamacare death spiral have been greatly exaggerated. So say Larry Levitt, Gary Claxton, and Anthony D'Amico, experts at the Kaiser Family Foundation, have put together a new brief analyzing what would happen if young adults snubbed the Affordable Care Act. Even if young people sign up at half the rate the administration hopes for, it would nudge premiums up only a few percentage points, this report says. When you do the math, it matters, but not nearly as much as the conventional wisdom suggests, Levitt says. The worry tends to go something like this. If young adults don't sign up for insurance coverage through the exchange, then the market loses a wide swath of very healthy enrollees and wouldn't have enough people to help pay the claims of the sicker, older subscribers. Without enough young people to subsidize the cost of the older enrollees, insurers would instead raise premiums to cover the higher costs, and that would make coverage less desirable to the young shoppers in 2015. Or if you prefer a little bit more hand-wringing, if enough young people don't sign up for Obamacare, premiums spike, the market goes into a death spiral, and the health law is doomed. Levitt has already warned that fears of this alleged death spiral are likely overblown. Now he, Claxton, and D'Amico put a few numbers to the argument. First, they start with an analysis of who is actually in the market of people eligible to buy coverage on the exchange. Those exclude those who are currently in the individual market and the uninsured who earn too much to qualify for Medicaid programs. Levitt and his colleagues then model what would happen if these people didn't show up. There's already some evidence that insurance plans are getting enrollees that skew older. In California, for example, only a quarter of the sign-ups are under 35. Most health policy experts expect the first wave of enrollees to skew older with the younger employees to follow. If young adults, those under 35, are 25% likely than the rest to sign up for Obamacare, they would represent 33% of the exchange enrollees rather than 40%. This means there would be fewer people to subsidize the older insurance subscribers. To make up that difference, the experts estimated the insurers would need to increase premiums by a terrifying 1%. Yes, exactly 1%.
Wow.
So I mean, that's kind of the contrarian view. That was put out, I guess, on the 17th, and I saw it first, I believe, on one of Greg Dworkin's thing on Daily Kos, the morning review. So, I mean, I hope that happens, but of course I do want people to sign up, and I want this to work for everybody. But, I mean, this is something that does have to be addressed. It really, you know, the prices are still too high, and we're dealing, you know, with a shotgun marriage with, you know, one party who all they care about is the money that they make. And so and they're going to have to decide pretty soon, I think in March, what the 2015 premiums are going to be. And so, because they always do that beforehand. So, you know, it's going to be an interesting ride. I still think it's going to work out, and I'm glad to see all these people signing up, getting insurance, and I think it's going to be great. But, you know, it's definitely something that should be addressed. I mean, it's really hard to talk about these things without, you know, addressing how we're going to, when you're talking about single payer, we need to talk about the money that we need to have for that. And
no, that's interesting. Oh wow, you're correct. I have the other. It seems like we're breaking up quite a bit. Let me see if I can go to a different mic here through a phone system and see if we can get that better.
Going to try to do is. Sorry about that, guys.
Okay, you sound good.
Yeah, I think I've got that taken care of now. Okay, what's going on is apparently we have some internet problems that's creating all these issues. But going back to the subject at hand, first of all, I'm extremely happy for that piece that you actually read, because what you've actually said in effect is that assuming we only get the 25% amount of youth that are signing up right now, that it stands for 1% increase in premiums. We've already seen that some cost curves have gone down because a lot of the payments that are going out are not going completely for fees for service, but actually sort of the totality of the totality of the service that's being given to people. Now, what is also great is that in the process, reality is starting to show up. And as reality show up and the other party that's being pretty much intransigent right now sees it occurring, they just may have to go on the bandwagon, because this cannot for success. I mean, right now things look bleak. The people are still sour in Obamacare. The people are still, young people are still being convinced that it makes no sense for them to go into the system because they're subsidizing the elderly, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if, since I was breaking up so much, there's a thing, a part of the post that I need to tell. It was a phrase from Ezra Klein. That let me get over now that you guys can hear me better. But Ezra Klein said the following: it is a mistake to think about yourself of having a singular relationship with the healthcare system. To say I am young and that's my relationship to healthcare is wrong. One day you're going to be old. You sound healthy, but one day you're going to be sick. And if every young person, every healthy person starts to game the system, then when they're old, when they're sick, there will be no system there that is affordable to take care of them. I've been at odds with Ezra Klein for a lot of what he's written in recent months, but I think that particular statement that he gave on TV was so, so accurate. What do you think?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, people need to, you know, people don't want to think about, you know, some things that are real serious, like, you know, getting in a car wreck or getting some kind of, you know, bad health issue, you know, getting cancer or something to that extent. But, I mean, you really do have to think about it. I mean, I was in a car wreck a few years ago, and, you know, it was terrible. I mean, I'm so glad that I had, you know, my car insurance and my health insurance, and, you know, it would have cost me so much money. I mean, it would have been, you know, insane how much money it would cost me. And, you know, I didn't have health insurance probably until my late 20s. And so, I mean, I know where they're coming from, because sometimes it's just hard to to actually have the money. I mean, that's what he was talking about, that he didn't really have the money at the end of the week to do it, you know, to
right.
make that extra payment. But in the end, you know, it is going to be worth it. And, you know, as far as getting single payer, you know, it's, you know, Democrats have to win elections. And hopefully that will come. I mean,
that is exactly right. I mean, it's about when, and that's why at the end of the post, I specifically said that I kind of encouraged these activists. I said that they had to stay within the debate. They have to be engaged because one of the reasons a lot of their policy necessities are not kept in, or not brought forth. It's because a lot of times they don't get into the game until it's near the end of the game or until they realize they don't have something that they need. You know, the reality is, you know, we look at the Occupy movement, which I am a part of the Occupy movement as well, but there are many times I was frustrated with the Occupy movement because ultimately things are going to get done electorally. And yes, that movement is so important and open the eyes to inequality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what happened after that movement fizzled, some on its own, some of it by force, there was no continuity on the right because there's, yes, some plutocratic backing. They are consistent. They are unyielding. Their message is completely on point, 24/7, through social media, through the airwaves, through the AM/FM radios, etc. We don't have the plutocracy is not going to support us the way they support the right because we don't really share. We share the interest of the middle class, which means that we're not going to skew everything upwards. We are going to make the system more fair. The plutocracy does not like that. So we are definitely not going to be funded, but there are many ways to skin a cat. But we have to not do things like have silly fight among ourselves. You know, we look at Carl Gibson. Carl Gibson is on our side. You know, I mean, he believes in these values. And let's say Carl Gibson, for one particular reason, had to do the penalty. Let's say that there was no other way but for him to simply go for the penalty, in as much as there is a hardship clause as well, okay? We must remember there is a hardship clause. But that said, let's say that he did that. To actually make that a modus operandi for the remainder of the youth by writing an article like that, I think it's a disservice not only to the youth, but to the country in general. Because what it does, is it creates a method of behavior that goes completely against even what he's aspiring for, a single parent. Ezra Klein made a very interesting point that, I'll be honest with you, I hadn't thought about all that much. I was always a favor of single-payer system, as I know you are as well. But what Ezra Klein said was, folks, hold back for a while, especially the youth. Don't think that you hate this program because it's not single-payer, when in a single-payer system, by design, the younger folks subsidizes the older folks at much higher levels. Reason why? Obamacare is age-based. In other words, people that are 55 years old, their premiums are higher than somebody that's 25 years old. In single-payer system, that isn't true. In single-payer system, everybody has the same rate based on their income, irrespective of their age. So that's something that one needs to consider. And did you ever consider that yourself, John?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of countries do single-payer and nationalized health, you know, differently. And, I mean, a lot of the countries that have nationalized health, like in Britain, it's just, you know, it just comes from the general funds, and so
right.
Everybody pays a tax. There's not a separate, you know, Medicare tax like there is here. Most of the European countries, it's the same way. The health care comes, you know, from the general fund, And so our system is a little bit different in that sense, is because you have younger people essentially subsidizing older people. And, you know, that goes back originally. The first system, kind of Social Security system, was built on that same premise. In other words, it's a lot easier to hold up a system that says, okay, I put money into this system. Now I'm just getting back what I put into it.
Right.
You know, that's a good argument to make, you know, for ever dismantling the system. If you were ever to dismantle Medicare, you would have to go against, you know, people who put in, you know, they work, you know, 50 years. I mean, they put in all this money, and you're saying I can't have that? I mean, it's,
right.
You know, that's a little bit different than, let's say, a Medicaid system. Now, personally, to me, it doesn't matter, because what matters is that you help people, whether they're old or whether they're young and poor and in need. I mean, to me, that argument doesn't fly. But with
right.
the general population, it does. They, you know, they understand that. And Francis Perkins knew that when FDR was designing the Social Security system. And a lot of the Medicare is based on kind of the same process. In other words, you pay into this money as a worker, and then whenever you retire or when you become disabled, if that happens, you get the money back. And so, you know, sometimes it doesn't come back. Sometimes, you know, you pass away before, you know, you're 65 and you never get the money. You know, and sometimes
right.
it's just the opposite. You may not make a lot of money, and you may, you know, especially near the end of your life, pay much more than the government puts out, much more than you put into it. So, I mean, there's all kinds of variations on it.
Well,
but,
you know, I bought term life for 10 years. You know, when my kid was in high school, I had a specific 10-year term policy that expired. I paid all that money into that policy for 10 years, and it was a bet against living or dying, right? And
right.
I happily lost that bet. <You know?
laughs> Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, I think a lot of what we have to do is change the way we think about certain things, because what happens is, you know, it's easy to demagogue something when, you know, when we look at Social Security as, I put into Social Security, so I should be able to take out. You know, we sell these things as programs as not what they are. These should be sold as social contracts. In other words, social, your contract with society. Your contract with society is you are going to pay this, and when you get old or when you get sick, we are going to take care of you. Not how much we're going to give you, but we are going to take care of you, because during the times that you were not sick, during the times that you could work, during the times that you were not old, you did your part for society. And I think that is what we've lost. I mean, individualism is great, okay? But there should be that particular break between individualism and societal need, or, you know, society, because we need them both. Individualism allows that differentiation between doing different things, eating different things, all these different things that are wonderful. But at the same time, you have to look at society as that thing that made us, gives us the ability to be individuals. Because do you think you could be individuals in other places where you don't have the support of the type of society that we have? Think about all the great things that what started with Roosevelt has done for our society going forward. I mean, think about what we would lose, not your generation and my generation, John, but the generation of those that are coming after us, that because we were the selfish generation, we didn't plan for the future of making these young people's lives better.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess the main thing that's probably going to make young people's lives worse is, you know, climate change and global warming, and we're
that's
definitely
true.
Not addressing that. but I mean, I think that the overwhelming need for greed and power is really what's changing everything. And I mean, I just hope that somehow we can overcome that. It seems like a pretty hard task right now. I mean, it seems that the media is promoting a lot of false memes that are getting put in the public sphere, and kind of it's very, very sad for me to think about it. I mean, one of the things that what happened with the Democrats being down 5 points in the polling, it really kind of disheartening. I know it's a long way until next year's elections, but
let me ask you something about that poll, because I saw the headlines but I didn't read it in detail. That differential, is that a total poll, or is that, in other words, does that include the entire population, or is that just people that are self-identified?
No, I mean, it was a CNN poll, and this is kind of the way that Rasmussen has also been, trending in the last 3 weeks. Anything can change. Earlier in the month, they were kind of heading toward Democrats. But, if you look at it, the rest of Obama's presidency, the big question is, if the Democrats lose the Senate, can he hold his ground against a unified Congress and basically not have all this austerity put into place?
He could not. I actually think
he can. I think that historically people there probably will be more shutdowns and things like that. But, to overcome a bill, you have to have, 60 – I mean, to override a veto, you have to have 67 votes. And so, if the Republicans do take the Senate and they send them all, the Paul Ryan Medicare budget and all these other, draconian laws, which they will, including, abortion rights laws and all these extreme laws that have been passed, throughout the South and in the parts of the Midwest, like Wisconsin. And, he's got to hold his ground. And so, we've had divided government quite a bit. If you look at the Nixon presidency, even Clinton, to where they held, the Republicans held both the House and the Senate, and not a great deal got done. But it wasn't so extreme like it is now, to where
That is a reason why I think otherwise, because I think, personally speaking, first of all, the way Obama governs is that he really, to some extent, he listens to elections. In other words, there's a lot that should have been done after that 2010 debacle. There's a whole lot of things that he probably did he would not have otherwise done. And I think a lot, just to keep the country moving, he would come out right to that stage and says, elections have consequences, and move forward. I honestly think the way he thinks is that if somehow Republicans were to come in 2014, I don't think they will, but if they were to come in 2014, and the country goes ahead and puts all these crazies in power, in effect, he's going to say, well, the country gone, that's what they want, let them have what they want. Maybe 2016 they'll see the error of their ways. I'll be honest with you. What I do, and I'm pretty sure what you do as well, is to try to keep the conversation going, to try to keep people reading things that are factual and enlightening, so that we don't have to be talking about this in the second week in November 2014 about what are we going to do now that we have a Republican Senate or a larger majority of Republicans in the House. I don't want to see that. So the reason I don't want to see that is the reason that I am going to be busting my butt to ensure that we inform people, to ensure that we get people registered to vote and become a part of the system. I think a lot, what happens a lot on the left, and this isn't referencing to you at all, but to many of what I see on the left, is the first time we see a poll like the poll that you saw, that you mentioned, immediately a lot of us go into the bunkers, as opposed to saying, uh-oh, we're not doing our job right. We need to get out there, get off or you know what, and get the job done. Because all it means is that they're doing the job a lot better than we are. It doesn't help that that our leaders, or not our leaders, but it doesn't help that a lot of liberal leaders, in when they screw up, example, when the website screw up, it doesn't help that the first thing they do is run behind a scene, as opposed to coming out, fighting, stating, this is a new project, this is what happened. Let me give a classic example of how poor our narrative is, John. Over the last week alone, let's talk about what has happened in the private enterprise system. We've had a major corporation, Target, lose millions of people's credit card, I mean, credit cards and PIN numbers, millions, the private sector. It's the bastion of American society. Then we've had UPS and FedEx unable to handle a surge that everyone knew was coming because of the online ramp-up that was issued by all the online industries, from Amazon right back to Target themselves, in getting their online business going forward. These were big, big private sector mess-ups that costed companies money, costed companies their reputation. If you watch a lot of people call me, oh, I'm not going to be shopping at Target anytime soon until I know for sure that they've cleaned up their act. That is what happened this week. In none of the messaging from, and not necessarily politicians, because to some extent those are their constituencies as well, as that they probably need to stay clear of, but there was nobody on the right, I mean on the left, tweeting in any substantial manner that, wow, the United States Postal Service, who's getting hell from Republicans, have been successful in handling the surge, including the surge coming from Amazon.com, because Amazon.com shifts a lot through the U.S. mail without a problem. That quasi-governmental agency, which has taken a lot of flack, was successful in handling the surge, but UPS and FedEx could not. In this case, a quasi-governmental entity worked, call any particular governmental agency yet, losing credit card and PIN information for American citizens. But we've had this occur not only with Target, but several other private corporations. I haven't seen that enter the narrative, not to demonize these private companies, but to show that these are just things that happen. As opposed to whenever the government slips, we demonize the government. Do you follow what I'm saying about the narrative and how poor we are with the narrative?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, actually, you know, I mean, what Clinton said is the era of big government is over. I mean, and I mean, you know, how you define big government, I guess, is different for everybody. But I think when you make statements like that,
right,
you're demeaning government, and you're demeaning,
yes,
the people who work for the government, including,
exactly,
you know, you're demeaning your own office. And
you know, that goes without saying, John, you're so right. And the thing about it is, I am proud to say I want big, right-sized government, because I want we the people powerful. I want we the people to be bigger than the biggest corporation. I want we the people to have more power than the biggest corporation, because we the people should reign. We the people should determine possible or what, how we want our society arranged. But if you listen to somebody who says they want small government and big corporations or huge private sectors and all of that, what? And if that is a narrative that should be challenged. But we are so poor in challenging that narrative. In other, that narrative could easily be placed in the right hands, and I'm not saying my hands because I'm not good at doing that, but it could easily be placed into the hands of somebody who can show that movement to unbalance. In other words, that movement where the balance is toward the private corporation is really a movement away from the people. It's easy to make a narrative like that. You know, I mean, I imagine if I sit down for 10 hours, I could come up with a song. So we are so poor at doing that sometimes you think it's not that we're poor in doing it, is that the leaders on the left are also on the take.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard for somebody to be, you know, anti-business. And, I mean, let's face it. I mean, most of the business in this country are corporations. I mean, that's just a fact of life.
But it's not anti-business, though. We're not.
Well,
we're
I
not
know, but
that's
the way that they feel they're going to be perceived as. If they come out, you know, I mean, too much against, let's say, Wall Street, or, you know, even you know, anti-corporate, you know, talking that way. I mean, Obama and, you know, a lot of the Democratic leaders don't want to be looked at as being anti-business. And I agree with you. It's a different perception of what is anti-business. But I mean,
and that is where we have to change the narrative, John. That is where I think it's not dependent on the Obamas or the Clintons or these other folks to do the narrative. I think this is where the left has to get a cohesive message. Aside from party, because I really don't care about the party per se in that regard. I think we have to get the message aside from the party in a coherent fashion. Our own think tanks. I'm not talking about these think tanks that are, you know, just tied to the Democratic Party. What I mean, a think tank that is tied to populism. You know, that is, I think, where we need to go from there, because ultimately, if we don't get there, you know, when you have a lot of people talk about these parties fusing into each other, I heard on one of the news stations that, you know, Americans are so upset with both parties right now that it just may be the opening for a third party. Well, you know, if there's going to be the opening for a third party, just let's make sure that party is appropriate, you know. But that said, I don't have much time left right now. But I'd like to ask you. I know you probably see what's happening with that blog post that I placed up there on Daily Coast, and I know you probably are somewhat disagree with the post that posting. Is that correct?
Yeah, I do. Which is kind of hard for me to you know admit, because you know I really am a great admirer of your
work.
Oh
no, absolutely not. That's what I cherish. I want to hear your opinion on that.
Well, I guess I'll start off by reading what the Fourth Amendment is. And so this is what the Fourth Amendment says. It says, the right of people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. And what a lot of people, I guess this is going back, I mean, James Bamford wrote various books about the NSA, even, you know, in the 20th century. And, you know, they used to call it no such agency. I mean, it was so secretive they wouldn't even admit that it existed. Mm-hmm. And so after, you know, 9/11, what happened to the country, my opinion is that it was such a shocking event that people really haven't put it in context yet, you know, because whenever I talk about these things, the first thing the caveat I have to give is, you know, if all those people who died, you know, whether it was the day of the event or they died because they inhaled the smoke, I mean, I have, you know, my deepest sympathy, and I really feel for those people. But what happened afterwards was just horrible, because it was, you know, the Bush administration took advantage of people's fear to create this surveillance state that helped, you know, private contractors mostly. And I just think that it's been incredibly detrimental to our country. The idea that people, they're going to die from a terrorist attack, the ratio of you dying is about the same as being struck by lightning. I mean, this is, they're just, the fear of being killed in a terrorist attack is just completely, you know, overblown. And we haven't come to grips with that as a country. And until we do, we're gonna have to deal with a loss of our civil liberties. And
I don't want to interrupt you. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think Snowden, I would agree with you that he is a flawed man, but I think what he exposed, and one thing that I do differ from what you write in your post and what Lawrence O'Donnell has said and what Joy Reid has said, they were all saying that basically what Mr. Risen and Mr. Lichbau and the New York Times, when they wrote their piece, I believe in 2005, this is all, you know, similar. What Snowden said is similar to what they were exposing. And the fact is that it's just simply not. I mean, he's exposed so much more, like the PRISM program, the X-Keyscope program, the metadata, the Tempora program. I mean, all these programs that people didn't know about before, and now they do know about. And the fact is, you know, with the PRISM program, they are violating the Fourth Amendment. I mean, this is my opinion, and a lot of civil rights lawyers will say the same thing, and you get a lot of, you know, different opinions from the other side. But in my opinion, whenever you get all of somebody's internet records, whatever they have put on the, you know, searched on the web for, or email, or Skype, or, you know, all these different things which the PRISM program encompasses, and also the metadata dealing with phone records, you know, you are taking away people's privacy. And it's not a search, like it says in the Fourth Amendment. It's not a search specifically for certain things. It's just to capture all the information, and then if it comes back, you know, somehow you get caught up in this web where somehow you had contact, you know, inadvertently or not, with somebody who they feel may be a terrorist, then they will come back to this. Now, this derived from what happened in Iraq in 2005, when it's an idea that basically we're just going to gather all the information, and eventually we'll try to get things that will help us in our cause. But okay, you know, this is not a good way to have to run a society. In fact, I feel it is an illegal program, and I also feel it goes against Article 12 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which forbids massive system of pervasive surveillance. And I would recommend a movie from Germany called The Lies of Others that talked about the East German, the Stasi surveillance state. It was an excellent movie. It came out about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. And how everybody was so, you know, set on informing on other people, and That is just not the way a democratic country should operate.
Let me get a little parting, because we're supposed to be over at 1, but I'm going to extend it to 1:15, because, you know, that subject, I think, requires some more digestion. First of all, it's hard for me to disagree with anything that you said, except one portion. I think this came across in the video as well. When Joanne asked Ryan from Huffington Post, okay, what would the civil rights people, not civil rights, civil liberties people, how would we change the NSA? Because I agree with you, right, that we have to have an NSA that is able to do its job without somehow law-abiding citizens not feeling infringed on by this big brother. I agree with that. My concern with a lot, and you know, with a lot of the complaints, and that, in this case, mostly on the left, is that it almost sounds like a something or nothing. In other words, we simply don't want you to have the ability to let's say gather data. Now, I think they come back and they say, well, you know, but if you get a warrant, it's okay if you get a warrant that has probable cause. That's what the Constitution calls for.
That's right.
That is there. Okay, but here's my problem, and this is what I've had with a whole lot of constitutional issues. I am pretty much not a constitutionalist. I am not a lawyer or any of that. I'm just an engineer, a person that believes in practical application for other geniuses' knowledge. That's all I am. And so, therefore, there are a lot of people that do all kinds of thinking into this deal. For me, the Constitution is a bit more simple, right? When the Constitution was written, there are a lot of things that were not known. Nobody knew about the velocity of the Internet. Nobody knew about nuclear bombs. Nobody knew about all these things that could occur, period. Now, my contention is I am looking for some sort of a balance. I think we should be looking for some sort of a balance. We can disagree until we work together to find a pragmatic balance that gives us some sort of security and some sort of privacy. I mean, I think we can work there. The problem that I'm having right now, John, is the way you express yourself is not the way. If you take a look at the post that I wrote for Daily Post on this issue, the responses were to slice me to smithereens, which I think is okay. I put myself there, and in the first sentence in the post, I said it. I knew that spades would be flying towards me for this post, but I had to say it anyway. And the reason I wanted to say that was to open that debate, but was also to show that how much some of us are so steadfast in what we so believe that we don't leave ourselves open for not a middle ground, but a pragmatic, workable ground. When Joanne says, "I get it, but please tell me, how do we solve the duality of what Americans want? They want privacy, and they want security." Now, if you are saying, if everything that we've done that we thought, let's say that the president's administration thought was the thing to do, you know, and a lot of the reasons the left have been quiet, it's because it is President Obama and not Bush. A lot of the reason he gets away with a lot of things with the NSA is because it's him and not Bush. We have to be frank about that. Bush was not trusted. Obama is more trusted as far as humanity is concerned. So in this period that we have now, we should legitimately have that conversation. But we're not going to have that conversation if people don't come at it from the point of view that you came about it. Egberto, I disagree with you because X, Y, Z. Now, I disagree with you, John, because of ZPX. How do we find a way that your privacy concern and security concern is the same that I can deal with respect to the part of government, the part of we, the people that is there to protect us? That is where I think we have to go. But if you look at a lot of the responses on the post, it doesn't lend itself that way. It almost sounds like a right-wing person attacking a left-winger at one of your blogs. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I read through the comments on Daily Kos, and, you know, people were getting a little bit vitriolic, and I thought that was unnecessary. You know, but at the same time, I think a lot of them were trying to make their point. Armando Lorenz was particularly shrill, and you know, I like Armando. He's on David Wallman's show, and you know, I think he's a pretty good guy, smart guy, you know, lawyer, and he knows a lot about constitutional law. But you know, I feel like what I disagree here is that, I mean, I want to have both also. I want to have security, but what I want is, you know, once you get that first, you know, essentially the first inkling that somebody, you know, could have a connection to a possible terrorist or, you know, whatever link that is, okay, go to the FISA court and get that. I mean, it's really kind of a rubber stamp, you know, court anyway. But let them do the rubber stamp. You know, I mean, I disagree a little bit. I was reading over some of Snowden's things, anticipating this conversation, and I do disagree with them on a lot of issues. I think that you can't have a regular, like, the reason the FISA court is there is because most courts, you know, the public records are open, so you can just examine whatever happens, and unless it's sealed. But, you know, you can't do that with these, you know, potential terrorist cases. And so I understand the idea of the FISA court. But what I'm against is this idea of bulk collection, and that's really my beef. My beef is you know, the PRISM program having mass collection of what you do on the internet, whatever you do on the internet, and also the system of what else? Kind of losing my train of thought here.
I know that
but,
feeling.
yeah, the metadata with the phone, the right. Phone metadata, which the guy from New York just said, he says that it was okay. I thought that was an incredibly weak argument to just say you can capture all the metadata and essentially, you know, have it in case you need to reference it. Well, I mean, that just, you know, if you just read the Fourth Amendment, this in particular, this part that says, but upon probable cause. Well, when you collect metadata, you don't have probable cause.
Let me ask you something about metadata, because that is the thing where I say the Fourth Amendment really I've thought about metadata when it was written. Let me give an example. If I have probable cause for material things, letters that were written, things that are material in nature, I can go back and find that information, right? Now, if metadata, if I don't capture metadata at the time, and a telephone company, let's say, had a, I don't know what it is, but let's say they had a 24-hour, I mean, it's longer than that, but let's say they had a 24-hour period of storing metadata, right? That is something that is never capturable because it's not, it is not something that is solid. Well, somebody could say then, well, if I have a paper trail, like, we could have also burnt it or thrown it away or whatever. Yes, but it was something that was a bit more difficult than the disappearing act of electronic bit. So I'm not disagreeing with you to disagree with you there. I'm trying to say, I think we want the same outcome: privacy and a safe country. How do we get there to make John feel that he is safe, and at the same time his privacy is being sufficiently maintained? I want to reach that point. I really want to get there. But I think we have to look at, we have to open our eyes to see, you know, all of us, myself as well. I'm not taking that against, I'm not saying I have the answers by no means. I mean, that was my opinion as far as how things are should be done. But I mean, I am as honest when I say that I am open to any method somebody gives that is pragmatic, that shows it will work. And I think if you listen to that interview with Joy Reid and Finney, a lot of the people on Daily Coast, or a couple of them, call them naive or call them shallow. I think I was called shallow as well, but it's okay. And you know, I think that is what they're asking for, or that's what we're asking for. It's like I can look at the Fourth Amendment and see your point 100%. I can see that. But then again, I can also see that if I obey or follow that Fourth Amendment by the letter of the law, that there is a very good likelihood that a lot of things that could be avoided would not be. That's all I'm saying. And I don't know if you agree with that particular statement, that if we follow the Fourth Amendment to the letter of the law, we really can't do any of these things.
No, I do disagree, because, I mean, we can do them. I mean, all the Fourth Amendment says is we have to have probable cause. Okay, probable cause is a very subjective thing, you know. I mean,
right.
I mean, and so most judges, I mean, that's why the FISA court, I think, has turned down one or two requests in the whole time of its existence. So, I mean, mm-hmm. if you go to a judge and say, you know, we think this guy's, you know, has some kind of connection somewhere, we want to monitor him or her. I mean, yeah, absolutely, do that. That's what that we should do that. But I mean, this mass collection, and that's what Snowden was saying on his Christmas message. And you know, again, I have a lot of things that I don't like about him. You know, mm-hmm. but what he was saying, and I really disagree. And I was pretty, you know, surprised and angry by what Lawrence O'Donnell, because he was totally dismissing Snowden the other night, and I felt that he was really being unfair when he said, you know, things like, I believe Snowden took it too far when he said, you know, we are being watched constantly. Okay, well, of course, if you're in your, you know, in your private room reading a book, I don't think you're being watched.
Right.
You know? But if you're on the internet and you're making a phone call, that information is being monitored. And
yes,
so you know, before Snowden said that, I mean, it was only speculation. Before he leaked this, it was only speculation, only, you know, tinfoil hat people said this. This is all supposedly shut down, you know, before.
You know,
and
I guess,
so,
you know, I guess, John, I think it's been maybe because where I come from, okay? Where I come from, I consider it a surveillance state, even though it's nowhere active like the United States technology or whatever. But if you look at all the plutocracies south of the border, I mean, anybody who they believe is doing anything is being monitored. People are generally being monitored somehow, some way, even by neighbors. I mean, it doesn't work as electronic as it does over here. But I have always assumed that back in 2003, when I was blogging under the dictatorship of George Bush, I pretty much, in as much as I knew it didn't help much, I actually paid more to keep things like who owned the domains that I registered to blog under. I kept those hidden. I kept a lot of these items hidden. I know if folks really wanted to find you, they could. But the thing about it is, actually in those times felt like I was in a surveillance state, and not only a surveillance state, but one that if you spoke the wrong thing would hold you. In fact, there are a few people who disappeared under George Bush. A couple of them made it onto Sixth Minute. So I mean, we know that really was occurring under George Bush. We also know that a lot of things changed under President Obama with regards to having to go to the FISA court for certain for these things, having to have somebody else other than the executive review it. Now, what Snowden came out and said about the kinds of things that are being collected, okay, yeah, you agree that those things need to stop. I agree that they need to stop when we find a viable alternative. I think we want to get to the same place A lot of the folks there constantly use the word things like naive or whatever.
Yeah, you're totally breaking up, Alberto. I can't hear anything you're saying. Sorry.
Wow, this time I'm wondering if that is mine completely, because I'm actually coming from a cell phone now as opposed to the mic, the mics from the system. Is it still breaking up?
Yeah, I couldn't hear anything you said. I mean,
wow.
That's a little bit better. Okay, now it's a little bit better.
That is interesting. I don't know what is really happening with our system today. But I'm so sorry, folks, for any bad sounds that's coming out of there. But anyhow, what I was trying to say is that we all want to get to the same place. We really want to get to the same place. So, I mean, I think we need to talk about it and not simply go back and forth calling names. I mean, if you have solutions, I want to hear them. Maybe you should, what would be a great thing for you to do? John, I would love, do you write at all?
Yeah.
It would be great for you to write a counter blog and on that, because I would, I think it's a healthy debate is a very important thing. And not only that, change some of our minds. Change some of us that feel this way and say, oh, but this is something that you're missing here. This is something that you're missing. That's the kind of dialogue I love to have.
Yeah, sounds good. I mean, I think that Snowden has woken a lot of people up, and I think that it's very important. And, I think that the people shouldn't have all of their information taken. I just think it's wrong. It's not the way a democratic country should operate.
If you're so inclined, John, I would and you decide to write up something, I would love to post it as a guest blog at my site. Let me just tell you straight up, because again, you're pragmatic in the way you express things.
Yeah. I mean, as far as how to change things, I just think that things should go back to the way before these things were set up. Just get the warrants and go from there. I do feel that we have a little bit of a different idea about what. I mean, I don't want to have any terror attacks happen. I mean, nobody does, but a very, very, very small percentage do. Very disturbed people want that. But I do think that this is part of the problem, is that people don't realize actually how few people get injured or killed from these attacks. And when these attacks happen, like the Boston bomber, they're so overpublicized and so sensationalized that the press is just, they know that people eat this up and it's good for their advertising, but it doesn't help the population, because it makes people overemphasize something that actually, that there's only an incredibly small percentage of something happening to them.
You're absolutely correct about that. I mean, the same thing happened. The folks in the gun debate use that as an example as well. We publicize every time a kid is shot by, uses a gun to hurt himself or whatever, that it is still such a small percentage. In fact, I had a discussion with one of my good friends here, a very lefty like myself, and he was sort of upset that I took such an interest in the gun debate, because he said that if you look at the whole issue, the gun, the people being harmed by all these crazy people that go on these mass killings, that it is so small in the entire picture of America. And he said even if you include the massive amount of deaths that occur on the streets by thugs, the shoot-em-up bang-bangs that I think gives us, 30-something thousand murders a year, or 30-something thousand murders a year. He said in the whole context of the size of this country, it is so small compared to other issues that we really should be pushing. And he pushed your pet peeve as well, our pet peeve, which is climate change and what corporations are doing. He's saying, in effect, he's saying we're putting a lot of issues on these things that affect such a small amount of people when climate change affects the earth in general, and we put so little emphasis in that. And he brought up a whole lot of other issues that we chose, that we choose to select when there are others that are so much more damaging. So your statement there is 100% correct in, you know, in that we look at the wrong things.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's always a tough decision. I mean, I think both you and I want to see income inequality and see the economic prosperity for the country, and those are kind of our top issues. And so, I don't think we've even talked about Snowden, or maybe a line here and there,
right.
just because that's not the on the top of our list. But I do think it is important, to a lesser degree. I mean, I don't talk a lot about foreign policy either, but I mean, I do like to be informed about foreign policy. And so, it's something, you want to be balanced. But yeah, I agree with you. I mean, the economic issues are to me the most important things. But there are so many issues that are important, though.
Yes, for, I know.
For women in Texas, I mean, they're going through so many horrible things, and the voting all across the country, how they're trying to take away voting rights, especially in Texas and in North Carolina. So, I mean, there are so many issues that are important, and you bring a lot of them up on the show, and I am grateful for you for doing
that. Well, I'm grateful for what you're doing, my friend. But let me bring, I think this is Jack Golden. We're about to end the show, Jack, but I couldn't end the show without making sure you get your piece and talk to me, Jack.
Okay, yeah. You recognize me. This is last, and I think the big deal is over the Republicans, immigration, it should be more important than what Snowden does. Snowden, to me, is a traitor. As long as he stays in Russia,
hold on a second, Jack. I want to make an addendum to my blog after speaking to John on the show today. I am going to I'm going to not remove but edit the part where I actually said my personal opinion is that he is a traitor, because I think John brought some good issues here where he stated some particular examples where that wasn't covered in the 2006 document. So I am still concerned that he actually did this out of the country, but I'm going to, after listening to John and some of the posts on Daily Coast, I am going to actually remove that word as traitor. But go ahead and continue, my friend.
Well, that should not be the most important thing. I think the Republicans brought it up about security. Security is important, but we don't want to become Orwellian. And I'm thinking of Big Brother's watching you. So, and the thing I want to discuss is the fact that the minimum wage. I want to go into that. Minimum wage is fine. It should not only be $10 an hour, it should be where I came in and worked for the post office and retired. It was about $16.50 an hour. That's a living wage. And one thing is that that should be brought up. I think it will be brought up within the next 3 months, and the next one is what you should do about a lot of things going on in Egypt and
All right, John.
Syria.
I'm sorry, but the show is coming to an end right now. So why don't you go ahead and give me a 30-second closing notice before I go back to John for his closing notice?
Okay, sir. I think I'm a little more optimistic than what I was a couple of weeks ago. I don't think we're going to have a threat of another government shutdown. I think the Republicans maybe learned their lesson.
But well, look, Jack, I think I'm with you. I think we all need to be optimistic, and I think I'm more optimistic as well. Again, I needed to get you in. I saw you come up kind of late today, and I needed to hear your voice before the end of the show, my brother. So, John, you're on. Give me your final notice for the day, my friend.
Yeah, I just want to wish everybody a Happy New Year if you're listening live or on podcast, and just really enjoyed, listening to your show and reading your blog post, Egberto, throughout the year, and I want to wish you a Happy New Year also. And I hope everything is better. I hope de Blasio and Warren lead the charge in 2014, and we can get some issues taken. I know January 6th is going to be a vote for extending the $1.3 million people who lost their unemployment benefits today, and a lot of them say they're going to be homeless. And so, the Democratic Senate will pass that bill. Will the House take it up? Is the question. And yeah, we hope so. And I hope to see minimum wage pass, like Jack was saying, and I hope to see immigration passed. I mean, realistically, is going to happen? Who knows? But you can always be optimistic.
Thank you very much, John. And first of all, folks, thank you very much for giving us a coffee party, Politics Done Right. Great year. I really appreciate every single one of my listeners. Please come back. Please share the show. Please make the show a lot better. I must say that there are some very regular folks that call in and add wonderful information. I want to personally thank you. You make this show. I mean, if it's not for you, it's just a monologue, and any monologue can get boring. Personally, I can speak for 3 consecutive hours nonstop, but you come in here and you make the difference. So for that, all of you, those that are on live today and those that are on live several times over the last few months, I really want to tell you that I thank you for being on the show, being a part of the show, and steering the direction of the show. Rest assured that, as I've always stated before, nobody has all the answers. I don't have all the answers. You don't have all the answers, but we have the answers. So the more we think about us, the more we realize that we can do better by using our differences for a better outcome, the more that we can look at ourselves and say, I am not tied to any particular idea if somebody comes up with something better. When we can do that as a people, then as a country, we will do much better. Happy New Year. Let's make the new year a much better year. Thank you for following. Thank you for being a part of Politics Done Right. This is your show. Please come back in 2014. I love all of you guys. Have a wonderful new year. Stay safe.